What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Kings and Priests. Dean.
Howdy.
What's up, man? It's good to see you.
Good to be seen. Good to be here.
You've been all over the place.
Yeah. Went to Australia, saw the parents, and caught up with some customers, and it was, 9 days in and out.
That's a good time for us. Much less than that, it's probably tough to even get adjusted.
Yeah, I've done a turnaround. Like, I did land one day and get back on the same plane for an emergency.
Oh, gosh.
14 hours in and then 2 hours there and then 14 back.
Oh, my gosh. That's cool. Was it the first time you'd seen your folks, like, since before the pandemic?
Yeah, 4 years. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Brutal. Because I was
so
planning
crazy.
Right, after COVID hit, that had been planned. And, of course, that got, shut down and... Mm-hmm. 2 years later, here we are. So yeah, it was a good trip.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. We got some cool stuff to talk about today. Just before we hit record, we were talking about, like, is the Elon conversation played out? Probably a bit. There's everyone that has anything to say about it has probably been said. But I did see this morning that Ben Horowitz tweeted that A16Z is joining the bid, investing $400 million. Into the company, which is pretty crazy. And I guess all but effectively probably kills Clubhouse, right? Especially since Twitter Spaces is the big competing product.
Yeah, I guess. I saw a Larry Ellison from Oracle. He's thrown in $1 billion. So
is he really?
Yeah, that came over today. So it's just interesting to see who all the kind of free thinking, free speech people are in tech.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the reports that he's going to take it public again in 3 years, I totally believe. So
yeah.
How cool is it going to be? He's going to buy this thing for 44, Morgan Stanley, everyone's got putting money in. He's putting money in. And I'll predict right now that when it goes public, it goes for 100 million or more.
Or more. Yeah.
In 3 years.
100 billion. 100 billion.
100 billion. Yeah. Sorry. 100 billion.
So, okay. Let me ask you a question about that. So I literally just for the fun of it bought like 15 Twitter shares.
Uh-huh.
They announced he was saying it over, the
right.
Stock popped, it kind of dropped back down. And I was like, this is pure for fun,
yeah.
Right? So when it goes private, I know he says he wants to figure out a way to allow the majority of private shareholders to stay, but that's probably only going to include like institutional shareholders, right? Like the average person that owns 10 shares of Twitter is not going to, their shares are going to get liquidated.
I don't think so. I think it's totally feasible. By the way,
okay,
for you to have stock in a privately owned Twitter,
okay,
just paperwork. So I would think he was for the little guy more than the institutional guys. But I did see like that Bin Alawid, Saudi Arabian prince, he's got 1.9 billion in there. He's keeping it in. Like everyone's letting their stock ride. So he's going to buy stock from sellers, but essentially. I think if you're invested, there's a chance you could stay in the private company and just let it ride for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the whole reason for taking it private is similar to, like, I think Dell did that, right?
Yep.
Where it's essentially like, we need a complete restructuring. We need to even maybe totally pivot in our business model.
Yep.
So it's almost in many ways like a restart. Is that kind of why you take a company private like that?
Sometimes the public stock price is so low and the cost of money is so cheap. It makes sense, and there's a lot of zeros, 44 billion, right? But the stock was so low, he bids like $54 or whatever it was, which is 10 bucks over, the trading price. And then, you go and reorganize it, refocus it, fire a bunch of people, put some vision in there, recalibrate the whole thing. And hopefully revenues increase, to the point where the public market would want to buy it again at a higher price. And I have no doubt that that's going to happen.
Yeah. I think if anybody can do it, he can, it seems
totally,
like, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. He's a legend.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And he's just funny. I mean, it's funny to see people hate on him so intensely. And I don't understand why, especially considering he is, if you're like a climate change, if you really care about climate change,
totally.
He's literally trying to change the world.
He's almost single-handedly getting more CO2 out of the air than anyone on the planet. And if you're a climate change warrior, he was their hero. And then the thing that they cannot handle because of their ideology is that he just wants a fair playing field for speech. And he looked at, and he's named them, right? Like the Hunter Biden laptop story being, you know, taken out of the town square, so to speak. He didn't like that. And that, especially now that's, you know, come to be true. So forget the politics.
Right.
I don't think he's a real political guy. I think he's he's just believes and understands how free speech functions within democracies, and Twitter's putting its thumb on the scale in a way that is hindering free speech and open thought around things they disagree with. And I think that's what pushed him to the edge. And and then like the left go bananas on him. The NBC is like, you know, hammering him, calling him an idiot. Like he's a,
there was a hit piece in the New York Times this morning.
Right.
About him. Another one. It's ridiculous.
And he just like he said to the NBC guys, like, you're the people that allowed Matt Lauer to have a rape office. You're the people that covered for, you know,
Epstein producer
that was doing all kinds of things. Like you are
Harvey Weinstein.
People.
Yep.
Yeah. And so he just throws it back at him. It's so good.
Yeah. And well, and I think one of the greatest things about him is that as someone who I started using Twitter when it was through text message.
Right.
And I mean, like, and so as someone who's just like always loved it, none of the people that have ever run the company were on Twitter very much, other than maybe Jack, I guess. Early days, Ev was on there a lot. But
yeah,
and you look at someone like Elon and it's like he uses it. He loves it. And I think that's what it needs, you know?
Totally.
So I want to tell you about this cool business idea. Well, not, actually, it's not a cool business idea. This really a cool business that I heard about the other day. So when I was in Las Vegas, we hired this kid who we met on the strip selling water bottles. So our business, long story short, we had an ad network inside of a bunch of taxi cabs. Those taxi cabs were geofenced so that if you were in a cab by the Wynn and Encore, you got served a certain kind of ad for high-end Ferrari, Rolex, whatever.
Right.
So we meet this kid and he's selling water bottles. He's in a suit, super sharp looking kid, selling water bottles on the strip for like $6 a piece. And I don't even remember how we struck up this conversation with him. Anyways, he also, that's what he did during the day. But in the evenings, he was a salesperson at like an art store inside of Caesar's Palace. Ultimately, they became a client of ours, advertised on the network, super sharp kid. Finally, we said to him, like, hey, why don't you stop doing all this? Come work for us and just spend your days walking into retail shops and getting people to advertise on this network. His name's Antonio. Great kid. He was probably 19.
Wow.
So just amazing. So I caught up with him recently, and he's doing this business called Funbox.
Okay.
And it started out as a few years ago, these like Instagram selfie museums were really cool, you know, where you would sort of like rent out a retail space. You would create like 10 different scenes for people to come in and walk around and take their photos in these really cool places.
Right.
So that was the first iteration of it. And he was living out in Westlake Village. And basically what he did was him and a partner designed for, I think it was like $250,000. They designed this fun museum for kids. Okay. And they did a deal with some mall. It was like a profit sharing deal. They basically got the space for nothing.
All right.
This kid flew back and forth to China like 12 times working with the folks in the factory there to build out this thing.
Right.
And then put it in this mall in, I think, Camarillo or something like that. And they did like, you know, I think it cost them like $400,000 all in.
Yeah.
I think they did like $800,000 in their first, you know, 4 month run.
Right.
He managed it, the whole deal. Got like young influencers to come. Anyways, so during COVID, they didn't know what to do because obviously malls are closed. No one's going to go take their kids into these indoor things. And so they went back to the same person they were working with for $250,000 more. They built a blow up, what they call like a fun museum for kids. And it's basically a giant inflatable amusement park.
I'm looking at the
way they put in
giant castle thing.
Yeah. That they put in mall parking lots and they do limited runs. They hire high school kids to run it.
Right.
It costs $250,000 to get one made. and they're averaging between in 3 and 4 months run between $700,000 and $900,000 cash in revenue. Oh. Wow. In these things. Okay. So what they've now done is they've put all their profit back in. They've built three more.
Yeah.
And they've got, I think, three or four going. They've got one in Nevada. They've got one in San Diego. They're about to do one in Arizona. And so now they've got four. And then now what they're doing is they're franchising this.
Right.
And just out of nowhere. And basically the deals that they strike with these malls and these parking lots are like next to nothing. It costs them next to nothing to run these things.
Right. So
yeah.
They're looking for any revenue possible.
And he basically, his marketing is he just hits up, he finds people in these areas, these kids that are popular on Instagram and TikTok.
Yep.
And he says, hey, I want you to invite you and your family to come out. That's all the marketing he does. He does no paid marketing.
Love it.
And this kid is, you know, building a real business.
I've been a bouncy castle fanatic. Like I literally called Chinese, like when back in the day, I wanted one of my kids' church rooms to just be bouncy castle. So I called this Chinese factory, and that was pretty cheap. And I bought three of them, and I set I set it up in a room, and it was the greatest. I had people like, oh, we've got to teach them scriptures. I'm like, let's teach them the Bible while they're bouncing.
Yeah.
And
yes.
And it was a hit. So I love it. I didn't go this far and giant big parking lot full of them, but.
Yeah. Well, that's the way I found out about it. He called me and was like, dude, like you start one of these. It's only two. He's like pitching me on the whole franchise process. And I'm like, man, this is actually kind of a really smart idea. It was kind of like a unique way to, especially with these malls being, you know, I know we're sort of past COVID, but I still think like suburban malls being like past their prime.
Yeah.
And I think we may have touched on it on this show is like, there's probably a lot of opportunity in places like that.
Yeah.
Come up with something, back,
you know,
yeah. Like
the Century City down the road here in LA, that's, you know, I never go to the mall really. I don't kind of shop at malls, but occasionally, you know, I'm there at the Apple store or something and it's pretty crowded down there. So, and that's a super high-end mall. I think the suburban gray, you know, beige box ones they're going to struggle maybe forever.
Do you think that there is cool opportunities? I mean, most of these are on what? Most of these malls are positioned in between a few different suburbs.
Yeah.
Like they're in very central. Like it would seem like someone's going to figure out something to do with these things, right?
I mean, Amazon, you know, I think Amazon's starting to buy them as, you know, shipping centers, right? As it's now probably cheaper to buy an old JCPenney. Is that the one that went under? And like use it as a distribution somehow. So they're gonna get just repurposed and you know, get used for something, because a lot of research goes into where to put a mall, and
right and
like, you know, they do all the studies and all the traffic flows and where all the people are and where growth is coming and where all the new homes are getting built, and so it's in that spot for a reason. Now, you know, areas do change, people move on, and you know, trends change, you know, over time, but they're in good spots for a reason, and so they'll get repurposed for something.
I just thought, man, what a cool idea, kid. It's just kind of like
about
making it happen,
entrepreneurial success. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah Okay, next I want your take on this. So obviously I think I just read again in March, this last March, hit a new record again of people quitting their jobs.
Yep.
In mass. So there's all this conversation about how do you acquire talent? Like it's more difficult than ever to acquire the best talent. And I guess there was this study, this poll done. And one of the big things that everyone is talking about is transitioning to a 4-day work week. So this poll says, you know, executives considered the schedule the most wanted recruitment and retention strategy.
Yep.
When polled, but only 6% of them said they are doing it or plan to. So it's sort of like, instead, you know, increase paid time off or maybe more flexibility. So as a CEO, you guys are a very flexible company in the first place. I mean, you've always been remote.
We've always been remote. I can attest to you that the labor market is indeed extremely tight and keeping talented people is extremely hard. We just did a whole company-wide, you know, raises in April, and I think we averaged 8%, right? Which is, we've never had to do that. And it's not that you don't want to pay your staff more. You do. Like, I want my staff really well paid, and we probably are just a tad above average. But, you know, I have kind of middle management people getting job offers, literally, you know, making six figures and like getting offered jobs with like 50K a year on top.
Wow.
More than I'm paying them. And I'm paying them well. and they're like got 2 or 3 years experience, which they've learned. You know, I love getting younger or inexperienced people or people who are switching industries. We employ a lot of stay-at-home moms to do our customer success and customer service. And, you know, it's great jobs for them. They don't have to, you know, they can sign off and when the kids come home, and there's a lot of flexibility. And what happens is over 2 or 3 years, they develop all these skills, right, and become really, really good at customer service. And they become very employable in the marketplace because they can – and it hasn't happened to us a lot. Thankfully, because they really love working, you know, in our company. But you upskill your talent in a fast growing tech company, and all of a sudden, you're worth much more in the marketplace. And then you've got startups with unprecedented amounts of capital to go and hire people like crazy, grow as fast as you can. And which is still the case, by the way, even though the markets are very public, markets are very choppy, the private markets are flush with capital. And so these, you know, these companies, they should be a little bit concerned about burning. You know, I think if you don't have 18 months of runway right now to burn, you're in a little trouble if you're not profitable. But having said that, they're still hiring like crazy, paying exorbitant amounts of money. And it's part of this whole inflationary supply chain bubble we're in. And just the economy is just not working. Like, it's not in sync. You know, so post-pandemic and everything crashed, and then everything exploded, and no one really kind of understood the demand that was going to come. And then throw in Russia war and throw in China, you know, shut down. And it's just like, there's literally, if the economy is a hose, right, and water's flowing through, like that's products and services and productivity and capital and money, like the water through her body, what there is, there's golf balls like that are stuck in certain sections of the hose. And so you, like, COVID was this giant golf ball. So it stopped everything from moving. And basically, and then it got shot through, and then like it's a fire hydrant now, but then you go around another corner and there's another golf ball, you know, called the Ukraine. And right. And then that just jacks up commodity prices, like a third of the world's meat comes out of, you know, Ukraine and Russia, and then you can't get the fertilizer. Come to find out, Russia makes all the fertilizer. So, just this event after event that public markets just are railing against. And then inflation, and then interest rates are going up, and uncertainty is everywhere. And, you know, it's going to be a bumpy 12 months, I predict.
So in that, if that's the case, do you think, like, if I'm a, you know, I'm a CEO of a one-man company, so I don't have to make these. I'm a, you know, CEO, right? But as a CEO of, you know, you lead hundreds of people, you have competitors. To me, the company that decides, we're going to adopt a four-day work week, like, I'm hoping my competitors want to start adopting a four-day work week, right? Like, anyone in this environment that takes their foot off the gas. And a four-day work week, no matter what anybody wants to say, I feel like, maybe I'm totally wrong, but it would seem like any company that's still trying to grow and innovate, is it possible to do that with employees only working 4 days a week?
This is a millennial thing. This is not a baby boomer thing, right? My generation would never go for that. This has come about as a result, and millennials are now leading companies and big companies, and essentially this work-life balance thing that is a thing, and I believe in that. And it's not like I think they do, if you do 4 day, I think it's mostly you do 4 10-hour days. So it's not like you're doing less, you know, 32 hours. You're still doing 40 hours of work. And I think the trade-off is that you get, you know, a Monday or a Friday or a Wednesday off. You can't have everyone off on a Friday if you're in, you know, if you're serving customers and you need support, right? So it's, you know, it's all staggered. And so, like, we couldn't have everyone off on a Friday. It's a really busy day for us. Nor could we do it on Monday. It's a really busy day for us. So if it is, do you want to work 10 hours, right? Do you want to start at 8 and get off at 6 for 4 days? I'd be open to that. I'm not open to 4 8-hour days and doing 33 hours work and lowering productivity. I'm not into that. And to your point, I think if I had competitors trying to do that, you know, and if it was 32 hours, I'm going to double down. You cannot win with now there's smart work, obviously, but just the nature of business and competition and everything you have to do to try and sell more of what you're building and, you know, get money in, work out what it costs you to make that money and spit out a profit. That's just, that's work and it's hard and it's, you know, so yeah, look, there's some tech companies that are, you know, SaaS companies that, that are buying into all this. One of the big payments guys, Bolt, is that guy, he's a young CEO. He was kind of the real big first kind of public champion on this. I can't remember his name, but he talks like a millennial leader and he's like, this is better for us. And look, it may well be better for your employees. I don't know. All I know is unless you've cornered some market and you're printing money and you don't, you know, need to do the kind of work to stay competitive and stay out in front, you don't see, you know, I don't think you're going to see Apple or Google or, you know,
switching to that, right?
Facebook, I just don't see it, you know. So I have mixed views. If it was 4 10-hour days, I'd be up into that.
Cool. All right, so next topic, the Berkshire Hathaway just had their annual meeting last weekend, which I always actually, I don't ever watch the full thing, but I always like watching the highlights just because those two dudes are like hilarious.
I know.
And they're even like their comments on crypto is just, they're just, it's like, they just have so much personality, right?
Well, like we were just saying, like you wouldn't see Charlie Munger, you know, stand up for a four-day work week. They would just.
No. But one thing that's I always find interesting about them, and it's funny because, again, I'm like no expert. It's just like I'm a very novice. It's just fun for me. But, you know, people always comment on what did Berkshire do? Everyone's waiting for the quarterly reports to come out to find out where they spent their money, what they invested in, what they sold, what they bought. And I think it always what it seems like anyways is their success always comes down to what they don't do. Right. They they kind of seem to sit on their hands. And wait, and then kind of strike at the right time. So I think last quarter, they literally, if I'm looking here, they deployed $2 billion. And then, which is right. And then in the course of just a few weeks, they just went ahead and pulled the trigger and deployed $40 billion. I think a lot of that was Apple, by the way. I think they bought a lot of Apple. And then, you know, Warren Buffett says, and now we're back to being in somewhat of more of a lethargic mood. Yep. Yeah. So basically they sit around, they watch, they learn, they wait, and then they're opportunistic. And to me, that's obviously not just investing, that's in life.
But they
seem to be genius at.
There's my few comments. Like this is, what are they, 60 years now with this? This strategy, so a long time. And his strategy was early was to buy cash flow businesses at, you know, pretty good prices. Think Geico, right? Just which was a government insurance company just printing money. And he somehow he got a hold of it, he owned it, and he used all that cash to go and start, you know, he piles it up. And then he waits for the next distressed asset to come along, and then he buys it, and then that prints all that money, brings efficiency, and he's, you know, it gets cost down, and then so the strategy is just buy, hold, efficient, you know, EBITDA pumping out the door, store up cash, look around, wait for a recession, wait for market downturn, go big, you know, then do the same. So it's an unbelievable strategy. You've got to be unbelievably disciplined, which those guys obviously are, and man, pretty awesome. And they don't buy into fads, and you know, like, oh, I don't understand technology. And so he probably lost a lot of money, like early tech, but he got on Microsoft eventually and wrote that and you know, Apple eventually. But
yeah, I think he's like one of the largest Apple shareholders now, right?
Totally. Yeah. And then like with NFTs and Bitcoin, like they're ragging on it like so heavily, but you watch.
Yeah.
At some point
they're going to get in.
Yeah. They're going to buy, you know, crypto.com or something for cheap when it all crumbles.
Yeah, exactly. He said, this is a quote I let Charlie Munger, you know, he says, turn a situation or problem upside down. Look at it backwards. What happens if all of our plans go wrong? Where don't we want to go? And how do you get there? Instead of looking for success, make a list of how to fail instead. Tell me where I'm going to die. That is, so I don't go there. It's such a great, just old, just brilliant quote. Did they do that because they're on the other side of so much success, right? Like they can afford to not be optimists.
Yeah. You know?
They're in like preservation mode, right? We talk a lot about being being optimistic, right?
I don't know if it's that or I think they just, you know, for lack of a better term, they like taking the piss out of people. Like they literally just say stuff that is, you know, like contrary and two curmudgeons that are billionaires, multi-billionaires and say whatever they want. But you look at that, what they've done in the last, you know, 50 years, it's unbelievable. And never split the stock, right? The stock is like, I don't know what it is. That's 150 grand to buy one share. And so they're like, yeah, that's what it costs. Keeps all the day traders out. They hate retail investing. They hate Robinhood.
Yes.
They're just, they want to buy and run businesses. That's what they do.
Yeah. That's hilarious. Okay, so last topic. This is something I've been thinking a lot about lately personally, and I think it's actually really relevant to anyone who's bootstrapping something, doing a side hustle, doing it on their own, maybe doing it with one partner, and always having to figure out like time allocation. I think there's like two sides of the coin here. One, I think nowadays in our like hyper productivity content world, some of this stuff is way overthought. You know?
Yep.
But this is something especially in the last month, have really been trying to drill down into. And I saw this tweet that was basically like this rule, right? Like there's one goal and that's basically get an ROI that is 4x your spend. So basically what this tweet talks about is basically look at everything you do over the course of a week, put a dollar amount, an hourly dollar amount on that. Right. And that's everything from emailing, scheduling, bookkeeping, sales, social media, like whatever that is. Try and determine where you're spending your money and where you're spending your time. And then essentially do whatever you have to do to spend the vast majority of your time on those like highest ROI tasks.
Right.
So this person essentially says, you know, scale the prioritization. Now, and basically delegate everything else. Go hire a virtual assistant, hire someone to manage your social media, whatever, all this kind of stuff, which all sounds really amazing until, like you said earlier, you know, you're a startup and you have a certain amount of runway, or maybe you're self-funding and you actually have to think every dollar I spend at some point is going to, you know, is going to run out. So what do you think about this? Like, I tend to be more of a, at least in my mind, never really actually making it happen. But like more like I read this, and I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I need to go hire a virtual assistant right now. Who cares what it costs? You know, like I need to be doing like the highest ROI stuff.
Right.
That's the way my brain works. And I don't know. What do you think of that? Like, is a lot of this just overthinking it? Or do you think someone that's in a really early stage of something really needs to look at this and dissect it and be strategic about it?
Well, first thing I'd say is I think the opposite to this. So, So in my world and how I do things, if I'm bootstrapping and I'm conserving my cash and I'm revenue or pre EBITDA, I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to work, like forget 4-day work weeks, man. I'm going to work 7 days, 15 hours a day. That's what I'm going to do. And if it means I'm going to do the emailing, or I'm going to follow up the phone calls, I'm doing it because I think, and that's, I'm just super old school on that. I'm just going to do it all. And
so can I ask you this real quick? Can I ask you this? Now that you're on the other side of you technically, Dean could say, I'm going to just hire, you know, do you still think that way? Or have you started to, I would assume now you go, okay, my time can be more valuable in certain areas than others, right?
100%. But here's, I just went away for 3 weeks. I was gone most of April and the business had a like record month. So I don't need to be here for my business to do well. But I do need to be here to guide and steer the vision and the mission of the company. And the things I do today are way different than the first 2 or 3 years. The first 2 or 3 years, I'm taking every call, making every sale, doing the follow-up, trying to keep the software from falling apart, getting more customers, answering the phone, and, you know, didn't hire the first person until I was literally like 12 hours a day. And I would wake up to 50 voicemail messages on my Google phone. And I'm like, and then I plow through those. It would take me, but while I was plowing through those, like another 50 were calling
come
me.
In.
I was calling them back. Mm-hmm. And then I hired one guy. And I said, here's the Google, phone that I was using.
Deal with that.
All these calls. He's still with us, by the way, Andrew. He's a great guy.
That's awesome.
So, but okay. So obviously if you're successful, so that's how I think you get successful. You're just, you're doing everything you can and you're not saying, oh, this is too many for me to do. I'd be better off doing. I'm just throwing everything at trying to sell the product and get mowed down by customers to the point where, you know, like when COVID hit,
you don't have a choice.
Yeah. That's the point that, you know, now you don't stay like that forever because it's exhausting. But when COVID hit and we signed up 12,000 churches in 6 weeks, we hired 8 part-time people who eventually all came on full time. And like, there's just when you have to, but if you're early and you're trying to conserve your cash, you should be doing everything you can and you should be spending as little as possible. You should put that money into marketing, you know, to generate more into your funnel and take every call and do everything until the point the way you can't. And then and now, obviously strategically now, you know, I'm talking to big denominations and, you know, I'm doing many different things that I was doing at the beginning, but that's because, you know, we got on the other side and we grew and we were profitable. And I think all that happened because, and I had 2 partners that did the same. You know, my CEO, Frank, did this. He had a full-time job and he would work, you know, probably 5 or 6 hours a day on Tidely before we could afford. We didn't have healthcare. He had 3 kids. He wanted to be working full-time, but like we couldn't afford his salary and we didn't have healthcare back then. Right. So
yeah,
like literally he worked 2 jobs, executive level, like important jobs. Same with my CFO, like and this goes back to the 4-day work week and this millennial kind of mindset. You cannot build great companies and businesses. Steve Jobs did not come in 4 days a week.
Right.
He lived,
slept,
dreamed, breathed. Pick any unbelievable company that's around today. The founders did not think, oh, this task is too menial for me.
Yeah. They didn't get successful by putting an ROI on a dollar amount on every single activity that they did. And
not at the beginning, right? In the start, you're just in the trench, like taking hits. So yeah, I think if this is a thing, it's startup phase and you're cruising a bit and now you can actually put more time into winning enterprise, big customers and, you know, everyone likes, if you are trying to win a big deal or, you know, everyone likes to talk to the boss, right? All my sales guys know that, hey, look, if it's a big customer, they're going to go, hey, would you like to meet our CEO? So anything that I can do then to help them sell stuff, you know, I do. But this is not a mentality for the first 5 years of your business, I think.
Yeah, no, that's great. Cool. Anything else? Did you read, listen to, watch anything lately that you'd recommend?
What am I reading? I'm just, man, I'm back on The Economist, man. I just read that thing every day.
Really?
Yeah. I try to read every article because it's such a global magazine. And so I really like being informed on, you know, the political eruption going on in Sri Lanka right now, or, you know, different parts of Africa, because I've been to a lot of these countries and, you know, I'm staying really tuned in on what's going on in Australia kind of lately too. Just, you know, I'm exploring new markets that, you know, I want us to go in. So I'm doing a lot of research, and stuff, but yeah, I just, you know, keep informed what's going on around about me, and, you know, listen to probably the same podcast as everyone else, and try to keep making good decisions. So,
yeah, love it. All right. Well, as usual, hit us up, shoot me an email, mw@vast.faith. If you have someone you think we should talk to, if you have an idea, if you want to hear, us talk about a specific topic. I know we're talking about just having a lot more folks on, some folks joining this conversation, different friends of ours, different people we're talking to that are starting stuff. So hit us up. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll see you back next week.
You bet. At Dean Sweetman on the Twitter machine.
At Dean Sweetman. Dean Sweetman, is your blog up? Are you blogging?
Yeah, deansweetman.com is up.
Deansweetman.com. Love it.
Yeah.
We'll see y'all next week. Bye.